Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little packers never mess with the big packers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. And on today's show, we are going to have kind of a throwback interview. I actually did this interview probably about 3 years ago on my BodybuildingLegendsShow.com video series. And if you are a fan of that show, or if you watch our videos on a regular basis, then you've seen this interview before with Roger Walker. But he has never been on the podcast before, so I thought I would put it up on the podcast for our loyal podcast listeners. And if you don't know Roger, Roger was probably the top bodybuilder out of Australia, competing in the 1970s and the 1980s. He was actually in the movie Pumping Iron, where he took second place to Ken Waller at the 1975 Mr. Universe contest for the tall class. And then Roger, the next year, went on to win the Mr. Universe in 1976 in the heavyweight division, when it was held in Montreal, Canada. And then he competed in the Mr. Olympia several times, including the infamous 1980 Mr. Olympia, which was held in his hometown of Sydney, Australia. And that was the one where Roger competed in his best condition and placed his highest at a Mr. Olympia, where he was sixth place. So in our interview today, Roger talks about his upbringing and how he got into bodybuilding, and he spent some time in the Marines. And then we talk about him, how he got started competing, first in England, and then he moved to Australia, and he became, like I said, Australia's top bodybuilder, and then won the Mr. Universe. And then we talk about his Mr. Olympia appearances, and he has a lot to say about that 1980 Mr. Olympia, which he absolutely did not agree with at all. So we've got a really, really good interview coming up with Roger Walker. You guys are really going to enjoy this. I do want to mention at the start that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe contest in 2012. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the two-time Classic Physique Olympia champion in 2017 and also now in 2018. And Breon also is the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia, Samir Banut, and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 when you go to oldschoollabs.com, and they will give you 12% off your order, or you can go to amazon.com and make your order there. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, and I want to thank everybody who took advantage of the book sale that we had this last week. It ended yesterday on October 6th. This is where I offered all three of my books, which includes Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 1, the MP6 Workout, and Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder. I offered all three for only $50, and that included shipping and handling, postage. So I want to thank again all those people that took advantage of that this week, and some of you heard it on the podcast, and some of you saw it on my Facebook page. So I appreciate your support, guys, and I hope you enjoy the books. I am still dieting pretty hard. In fact, I've got a photo shoot set up with my friend Tony Mitchell out in Chicago, and Tony did some great shots of me, but it was all the way back in 2011, if you can believe it. I can't believe it's been that long since I shot with Tony. So I made arrangements with him. I'm going to be shooting with him on November 13th in Chicago. So we'll probably try to do some other photo shoots, maybe in the Florida area. And I'll probably do it all the way up until Thanksgiving, which will be the week after the photo shoot I got set up. So I'm really hitting the diet hard now, and I'm hitting the training hard. I'm training 5 days a week. I'm training my legs twice a week. I do the heavy workout on Tuesday, and then I do a lighter leg workout on Saturday. And no more cookies. I gave up those cookies, man. I'm just really going strict. No more cheating. I'm trying to get my waist down a quarter of an inch each week, and hopefully I can have it down below 33 inches by the time we do the photo shoot. I'm getting real close. I can see my abs. I just got that little bit on my lower abs. So it's getting really close now. I'm going to really, really push it hard. so I can look the best I can look. For my photo shoots, I'm going to try and do several of them. So I'm getting excited about that. I also got another seminar coming up in Baltimore, which will be in 2 more weeks, and that'll be the weekend of October 19th and 20th and 21st. And this is with, again, the AAAI ISMA. This will be my 4th seminar with these guys this year, and I'm so excited about doing that. I'll be teaching the strength and conditioning class on Saturday, and I'll do my natural bodybuilding class on Sunday. So if anybody's in the Baltimore area and you guys want to come out and see the seminar, just contact them at AAAI-ISMAFitness.com, and you will see the advertisement for the Baltimore conference. And they got a lot of stuff going on that weekend. But, yeah, you can just come by and check out my natural bodybuilding seminar. All right, last week we had our interview with Tom Terwilliger, and that was part 2 of our interview. The guys over at Bodybuilding Nerds Radio, VJ and Scott McNally, they really liked it, and they gave some a great review on it. So thank you guys for that. And Brad Allen, who is a frequent listener of the podcast, he wrote on my Facebook, "Oh, man, what a great interview. Tom effuses positivity and his genuine passion for bodybuilding and life were actually uplifting to listen to as he reminisced. It got me thinking about all those interviews you've done, John, and isn't it interesting how positive and truly intelligent all these quote-unquote musclehead bodybuilders all are?" Also got some emails at naturalolympia.com, my email address, or you can also, like I said, guys, email us through the website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com. This email came from Adam Musovich, and he said, "Hi, John. Firstly, I'd like to just echo the sentiments of many others and say how much I enjoy the podcast, and I appreciate your passion towards bodybuilding and all the work you do, all while still living the lifestyle. Boyer Co., John Brown, and Dorian are being the ones that first come to mind, but they're all good. Bill Pearl would be the ultimate interview. I'm not sure if you've reached out to him in the past or how his health is, but I do remember that Chris Dickerson mentioned that he still spoke with him and he was still doing well. As far as ideas for other series," which I do ask for you guys all the time, if you have any ideas for other series or interviews, Adam said, "maybe a Miss Olympia with some of the competitors like Bev Francis, Carla Dunlap, Corey Everson, etc., could be interesting as to discuss the rise and fall of the division in the pro ranks, what it was and what became. I also think Lee Priest would be a fantastic interview as he's not scared of offending anyone and is always honest. Thanks again, John, for the effort you put in. Regards, Adam from Melbourne, Australia. P.S. I'd also like to purchase your books. Please let me know the details you need and I'll send through some kind of payment. Also, not to waffle on, but I'm also a natural competitor who loves the posing routines of the classic bodybuilders. If you're interested, I can send you a clip of one of my routines to check out." All right. Thank you, Adam. Thank you for that email, and thanks for your ideas. I also got a letter from Rich Curtis, and Rich says, "Hi, I discovered your podcast about a month ago. I have been listening to one every night, and I absolutely love them. Thank you. Your interviewing style, extremely informed yet unintrusive, is as good as any as I've heard. Actually, it has a lot in common with that of Brian Lamb of C-SPAN. I particularly enjoyed the Boyer Co. interviews. Great guy, modest guy, great memory. However, I was slightly bothered by the story he tells about Robbie from the 1994 Masters Mr. Olympia. Boyer starts out by saying the contest was invented for Ferrigno to win it. Then Boyer says everyone knew Ferrigno would win it. Then Boyer says Robbie should have agreed to Boyer's last-minute idea that all the prize money should go to the winner on the grounds that you go for the love of the contest, not the money. Now, does any of this make any even an ounce of sense to you? If the point is love of competition, then why try to change the rules at the last minute in order to rearrange the distribution of prize money? And how does Robbie become a bad guy for simply wanting to play by the established rules at a contest that Boyer himself was designed for Ferrigno to win?" Well, I think what Boyer was saying was the reason they invented that contest in the first place, the Masters Mr. Olympia, was for Lou Ferrigno, because Lou made his comeback in 1992 and in 1993 at the Mr. Olympia, and he was really not successful. I think he took 13th place or 12th place in his first one, and I think he was maybe in the top 10 in the second one in 93, but he could not beat the top guys at the time, like Dorian Yates and Sean Ray and Kevin Lavroni and those guys. So I think they invented, I think he talked to Joe Weider. That was a story that Lou Ferrigno talked to Joe Weider about having a Masters Mr. Olympia, And that way, Lou could achieve his dream of finally winning the Mr. Olympia. And as far as the prize money, I think it was going to be distributed among the top competitors. And then Boyer said that we should just have the winner take all because they weren't making much anyways. The prize money wasn't that extensive. So why not just have the winner take all? These guys were just doing it because they love competition. They were coming back. I think that's what he meant by that. So I understood what he was saying. But thank you for that email, Rich, and I'm glad you're enjoying the podcast. There was some controversy this week in the bodybuilding world regarding Phil Heath, because Phil, of course, was beaten a couple weeks ago by Sean Roden, and he has won 7 Mr. Olympias, and now he is wondering whether or not he should compete again. I guess he did an interview with Dave Palumbo, and I think he said he's not going to compete next year, but he's going to compete in 2020, which I think is a mistake. If he wants to come back and win, and I think he should just come back next year. But he has been doing a lot of interviews. He did one with Generation Iron, and he did one with Dave Palumbo. But I guess the controversy this week was about an episode that was on Advices Radio with our friend Scott McNally from Bodybuilding Nerds. And he had on somebody, a football player, a professional football player. And this football player claimed that Phil Heath stole his $100,000 bracelet, which I guess the football player let Phil Heath hold on to it for a while, and then he never got it back. So Nick from Nick Strength and Power, who has a lot of viewers and a lot of people listen to his show, he heard the show on Advices Radio and he talked about it. And now Phil Heath wants to sue Nick Strength and Power for defamation of character. So Phil looks like he's having kind of a breakdown. He's not really handling this loss very well. And he sounded very, very defensive on part one of the Dave Palumbo show that I heard. And he was saying that he had Phil Heath beat on several of the shots. So if you count up all the mandatory poses, he had Sean Roden beat on more shots, and then he deserved to win the title. I think what Phil Heath is missing, the point here, and I remember when I interviewed Dorian kind of said the same thing when he was talking about his torn bicep, and he said, but he still won most of the poses. My opinion on this is bodybuilding is not judged on the mandatory poses alone. Bodybuilding is a sport that is subjective judging, and they are just looking at the physiques. Now, they go through rounds of judging in order to decide who the winner is, including the relaxed round, the mandatory poses, and they also used to judge the posing round, which they do not do anymore. But the whole idea of having these 3 rounds is to then decide who is the best after viewing all 3 of these rounds. And they used to judge each round separately. Now they just give one final score as who they think the winner is. But the point is that the judges in a bodybuilding competition are using subjective judging. They are looking at all the 3 of these rounds in order to decide who is the best. But in the end of the day, the judges decide who is the best based on their opinion of having viewed these physiques in all these different rounds and all these different positions and different poses, and then they decide who is the best. They're not deciding just on the mandatory poses. It's not like there's 7 mandatory poses and Phil Heath wins 4 out of 3, so he's the winner. No, they're just looking at the total physique. They're not judging the mandatory poses. They're not scoring it. This isn't a scoring contest like a lot of other sports. So this is just an overall view, an overall opinion, and they're using the rounds to decide that opinion. The overall opinion of the Mr. Olympia this year was that Sean Roden had the best physique. He was harder. He had that washboard stomach. He was more aesthetic, and that's why he won the show. It's not about posing, you know, it's not about judging the different mandatory poses. So Phil Heath is way off on that. And I don't think he really understands how bodybuilding is judged or how bodybuilding should be judged. That's not what bodybuilding is. Bodybuilding is just your overall assessment of the physiques. It's not a scoring contest on mandatory poses. So I think Phil Heath deserved to lose. I was at the show, and he had that stomach sticking out, and he said his stomach looked just that same way last year. So he was arguing, why did I lose last year? Well, a lot of people think he shouldn't have won last year either. So I think the judges made the right decision, and I hope they stay with that judging criteria. I hope they still keep picking aesthetic physiques with the small waistline, because that's what a Mr. Olympia winner should look like. That's what any bodybuilding champion should look like. So I hope the judges stay with that, and we will see what happens with the career of Phil Heath. He's not handling this loss very well. Yeah, if you compare his loss to like when Jay Cutler lost in 2008 to Dexter Jackson, Jay just stayed quiet. He didn't say anything bad. about Dexter beating him, and he went back to work, and he came back the next year looking phenomenal, and he deservedly won the title in 2009. And that's how a champion handles loss. And Phil Heath is not handling this very well. But as he said in his interview with Colombo, he's never really lost that much. He didn't lose much as an amateur. He went to the Junior Nationals, won that on his first try, then went to the USA, won that on his first try, turned professional, and I think he won his first three or four pro shows. So he hasn't had many losses, and now he is having a very hard time dealing with this loss. And I think if he stays out of competition next year, I think he's done. If he waits 2 years to come back, that just doesn't make any sense. If he wants to come back, he should come back immediately. So that was the case with Phil Heath this week. A lot of drama in the bodybuilding world. If you guys are into movies, which I love movies. I love going to see movies. I've been a big movie fan ever since I was a kid, and I still am. We finally are in the good season for movies right now, which is the fall season. And I just saw A Star Is Born last week on the night it premiered, and that was a really, really good movie. Bradley Cooper stars in the movie with Lady Gaga, and Bradley Cooper directed this movie. In fact, it was the first movie he ever directed, and he really did an outstanding job, and it was probably his best performance. And, of course, Lady Gaga was amazing, and it was really, really, really well-done story, and the crowd loved it. When I was walking out of the theater, I was listening to people talking around me, and just people just loved this movie. So I think it's going to be very popular. I think it's going to make a lot of money, and I think it's going to do really well in the Oscars. So check that out if you're looking for a good movie to see. Venom opened up also, which is, I think he's a villain in the Spider-Man comic books, and they gave him his own movie. And I think they're going to develop these different villains to have kind of a series of movies leading up to a big Spider-Man movie. I think that's the whole plan that Marvel's doing. I haven't seen that one yet. I probably go see that one coming up. And then we've got First Man coming out next week, which is a Damien Chazelle movie who did La La Land, and he's one of my favorite directors. And this is about the first man to step on the moon, and Ryan Gosling is again starring in that movie. So that got great reviews. I'm looking forward to seeing that next week. And I was told by Dan Solomon that Bigger is coming out next week on October 12th. So look around your theaters in your area and see if that is playing. Dan said it'll be playing in Tampa where I'm at. So I'm going to try and get out to the theaters next weekend and see that. I've got to work every day this week, but I'm going to try and make plans one day to fit around my work schedule, my workout schedule, and get to the theater and see that in the movies, because I definitely want to see it in the theater and not on TV. So be aware of that movie. That should be coming around pretty soon. And I also want to mention, guys, that we are brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. Their certified and knowledgeable staff will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. Their wide range of services will ensure that you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So check out their website at flalternativemeds.com, or you can call them at their office in Tampa, Florida at 813-922-8939, or again, check out their brand new website, flalternativemeds.com. Mention that you heard the ad here at Bodybuilding Legends Podcast, and they will give you a free consultation, and they'll also give you 20% off of any order. All right. Well, thank you to Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. And here is our interview with the great Roger Walker. Enjoy. All right. Welcome to the Bodybuilding Legends Show, and I'm very proud to have with us today Roger Walker, calling from Sydney, Australia. Roger, how you doing?
Fantastic, thanks.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I know you're on the other side of the world, and I appreciate the time difference and joining us for the show.
And this is my afternoon nap time.
Okay. I appreciate it.
No, I'm joking.
Well, Roger, let's talk about your bodybuilding career. I was lucky enough to see you compete at the Mr. Olympia back in the late 1970s, because I attended that show from 1977 through 79, and got to see you compete with some of the best in the world. But let's talk about the very beginning, Roger. What got you into bodybuilding? When did you start lifting weights?
I was in the Marines.
Okay.
I joined the Marines when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And it was a Marine Academy. And they didn't take any, they didn't bear in mind that you were just a kid.
Mm-hmm.
They were men and they wanted to inflict punishment.
Hmm.
And what they would do is, and we would have PT lessons almost every day, swimming and running and all those horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And they would run you till you dropped. So I decided to beat the instructor.
Hmm.
That was my game.
Okay.
So in my free time, which wasn't very much, I practiced chin-up, push-ups, sit-ups, burpees, stuff like that.
Right.
They used to take us on rope climbing, and they would hang you up there until you fell off.
Wow.
And it was a concrete floor. And so they were quite unkind. Unkind. So I played beat instructor, and I did, and they hated me. And that's how I started training.
Okay. How long were you in the Marines for?
I moved from some chin-ups and push-ups to graduate to weights.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in the Marines for, Roger?
About 10 and a half years.
Wow, really? Okay. So when did you start lifting weights? How old were you then?
About 15.
Okay. Okay. And then what got you into bodybuilding? Was there somebody that inspired you, or?
I think it was a gradual sort of, well, I always wanted to be successful at something.
Mm-hmm.
This just happened to be the bus that came past.
Yeah.
I really wanted to be an Olympic lifter. But there was no instruction and no Olympic bars.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to be a bike rider, but I couldn't afford a bike.
Okay.
So this was a vehicle that came along, and I jumped on this, and I thought, maybe I could be good at this.
Yeah. Did you feel you had good genetics for bodybuilding when you started lifting weights?
I didn't really understand the concept. I was arrogant enough to think that I was strong.
Uh-huh.
And I think if you think that, then you are.
Okay.
I enjoyed the physical outlets. I enjoyed doing more push-ups, doing more sit-ups or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
than people. I enjoyed beating people.
Yeah.
That sounds horrible, but that's why I enjoyed doing it.
Right.
Okay. I enjoyed winning.
What was your first contest then, Roger?
That was, well, I think that was this Southeast England.
Okay.
In the sort of 67, maybe 68.
Okay, okay.
That's when novice contests really were novice contests.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, sometimes you look at novices now, and they shouldn't be at the contest. They're too good.
Yeah, right, right. Now, were you born in Australia, or were you born in England?
No, I was born in England.
England, okay, okay. So what was your experience like doing that first show?
I hated the posing.
Mm-hmm.
I did find somebody who had entered a contest, and I said, well, how do you do this? So I wasn't training in a gym. I was training in a military gym.
Okay.
So there weren't bodybuilders around. So right. I wasn't getting a lot of information. And remember, there was magazines were hard to get and expensive.
Mm-hmm.
There were no good supplements. I didn't even have a training belt. silly. But I did find someone. I said, well, how do you pose? And he said, well, you do this, this, and this. He said, and then you do this. And that was it. There was, okay. Of course, no news or anything. I went up there, and I did it, and I came fourth.
Okay.
And I was quite happy with that.
Okay. Did you get inspired to do more shows after that? Did it sort of motivate you?
Yeah, because I looked at the guy who won, And I thought, well, I can do better than that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I don't believe he ever competed again. A few months later, I entered the South Britain Novice.
Okay.
And because I had a friend travel with me, old man, coat. And I came fourth. But again, that was a different line out. The south end of England, with respect to the others, is probably the toughest area in England,
mm-hmm.
as far as bodybuilding is, or was at the time anyway.
Yeah.
So I came fourth. And then I had a 2-year period of time where I wasn't able to compete. But I was sent away to funny parts of the world to meet interesting people who didn't like me. So I sort of disappeared. Well, I hadn't disappeared. I disappeared for 2 years.
Uh-huh. No, you were still... So when you started competing, you were still in the military then, in the Marines?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
yes. Okay. And then what was your next show after when you got home?
Well, I was on a ship. I was on an aircraft carrier for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
And I read people talk about using the stabilizers, and I think, what a load of rubbish. if you've ever tried to work out on a moving platform,
right,
you realize
right.
how difficult and how dangerous it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And 1 minute you're squatting 200, and then when the weight goes down, it's 500.
Right.
And I used to lie in my bunk praying for a cool, calm day. And when it was, I'd run down the 6 or 7 decks where I'd have my own little tiny gym.
Uh-huh.
And this was before ships had gyms.
Yeah, right.
I had to go and buy all my own kit. And I squeezed it in between two lockers and a fuel exchange dipper. It was like training in a gas station.
Jeez.
And sometimes the gas would overflow, so you'd have 2 or 3 inches of ab gas floating around your feet.
Wow.
And every time I smell that, it takes me right back to...
Yeah.
I was determined to come off in better shape than I went on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is like being sent to jail.
Yeah.
In that.
Right.
All I wanted to do was, I didn't give a shit about the job anymore. I just wanted to work out.
Right.
And get started. Now, before I went away, I'd been in a contest with Johnny Fuller.
Okay.
And I'd beaten him. Or had I beaten him? Yeah, I think I beat him. That's right.
Uh-huh.
Well, I got back from wherever I'd been, and I heard, and I'd only been a short 3 months, and I heard that there was a contest. It was another novice, I think it was a novice Southeast, fronted up, and Johnny Fuller was there.
Okay.
And we both stripped off. He looked at me, sort of sneered with a half laugh, as if to say, I've got you.
Yeah.
And he had.
Yeah.
And that was really, really annoying. Now, it's not supposed to be a physical sport.
Right.
But I found it really annoying. But I took that on board and I used that. And he beat me fair and square. He was in great shape.
Mm-hmm.
But I used that as a motivation. I thought, well, next time we meet, it'll be me who does the little sneery laugh, ha ha, routine, which I didn't, as it happens. But that was the first time back I had my ass kicked. Yeah.
Okay. And then, you were still in the military then when you got back?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was in. Yeah, I didn't leave until 72.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So this was still late 60s, maybe early 70s.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So I'm looking at this website here. It's got your contest history. It says you did the NABBA Mr. Britain in 1972. You got third place there.
Correct.
Yeah.
In the same year, I won the South... I think the South or the Southeast Britain.
Okay.
I won that open title.
Okay.
In the same year. That was a preliminary before you could qualify. That was a qualifier.
Okay.
For the Britain.
Now, when did you move to Australia, Roger?
End of 72. But before I went, I also won the IFBB Mr. UK, IFBB, and the IFBB Britain as well.
Okay.
So I'd won two IFBB national titles.
Now back then, in the early 70s, was NABBA bigger than the IFBB?
Yes.
Okay. So the IFBB was...
Well, it was in the UK.
Yeah.
And it probably was in the States, too.
Yeah. So the IFBB was just sort of starting to come up at that time, right? Early 70s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I know NABBA was around, I think, since the 40s, right? So that was pretty well established.
Well, I think, what is it, 1950 was their first unit.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I think you're right, yeah.
And it was a pretty, they were pretty run shows.
Mm-hmm.
There's always politics involved in contests and what have you, but they were about as straight as you could be.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, did you ever go see the Mr. Universe at that time, back in the early 70s?
No, I could never get the time.
Okay, yeah.
I could never get the time away.
Mm-hmm. What was the reason you moved to Australia from England?
Sunshine. Sunshine. I was standing at a bus stop at 5:30 in the morning, waiting for the bus to take me to the dockyard.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, what the beep am I doing here? It was so cold. It was so cold. It was coming through the soles of my shoes.
Yeah.
And it was that drizzle. Have you ever been to England?
No, I haven't, no.
It rains every day, all day.
Yeah.
And it's that drizzle that soaks through everything.
Yeah.
And it makes everything damp, makes your bones damp. If you've got arthritis, you'll die. So it was 5:30 in the morning. I thought, what the hell am I doing here? It's time to move.
Mm-hmm.
I did.
So what were you doing in Australia when you moved out there?
I joined the Air Force.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because at that time, all I'd been is institutionalized.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a bad thing.
And then you obviously continued your bodybuilding career out in Australia, right?
Yeah, I entered the Mr. Australia in 1973.
And you won that one, right?
Yes, sir.
How was the competition in Australia compared to England?
It was pretty good. I mean, I just come from a place where meat was expensive.
Uh-huh.
Gyms, as we knew them then, were difficult to find. If you needed a tan, good luck.
Right.
Because it wasn't a sunshine. And I'd gone to a place that was like milk and honey.
Yeah.
Sunshine, beaches, cheap food, meat by the pound.
Yeah.
And all these guys lazing around, and I thought, these guys have got it easy.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know they had it easy. That was my take on the whole thing.
Right, right.
And the mentality was exactly the same. Bodybuilders the world over live on gossip and innuendos and lies and all sorts of stuff, right? It's the same.
Right.
It was still the same. Half of them are mad. And it was exactly the same. I found it.
Right.
Half crazies.
Yeah.
So I won that. And, the competition was good. They were probably better than they thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
Because there hadn't been a lot of Australians traveling overseas. And competing against the rest of the world.
Right.
So I got the impression a lot of them thought that foreign bodybuilders were unbeatable, mm-hmm. particularly the American.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're American, you're unbeatable. I can't beat you. That was the mentality that I felt was at the time.
Now, at that time in 1973, were you just doing it just for fun, or did you have plans to, you know, win Mr. Universe and then move up and possibly compete against the best at the Mr. Olympia?
Well, if I could take you back to when I was 16.
Okay.
I had a dream. I had a goal that was so audacious that I didn't tell anyone. I had decided that I wanted to be the best bodybuilder in the world.
At 16?
Yes. Now, I didn't tell anyone because they would have laughed at me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, remember, I wasn't training in a gym. There was no instruction. The weights were in a great big box. There was no machines. My bench was the top half of a vaulting horse. My tinning bar was the top. I had to climb up the top level of two heights of wall bar. Remember, you know, gym wall bar?
Mm-hmm.
So if I stood on top of the wall bar and swung over, I could do my chins on the beams across the ceiling. So I was 15. So I was, and it was a concrete floor, and I never missed a beat.
Hmm.
I would have broken my legs. So that were the conditions. So if I would have actually turned around and said, I'm going to be Mr. Universe or the best in the world, people would have thought I was crazy.
Right.
I couldn't tell anyone. I didn't tell anyone. And it wasn't until actually quite recently that I told people about this goal and how I've only just recently shared it.
Yeah.
Because it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But every night I would run through the workout that I was going to do the next day.
Mm-hmm.
I could actually, I was visualizing, and I could visualize crowds. I could actually feel myself pumping up when I was going through my workout.
Wow.
So I'd know exactly what I was going to do the next day. And you know, you get that excitement when you know you're about to work in, go into a gym, and your adrenaline comes up a bit.
Right.
And it's like you've had six coffees and you're trying to get a sleep. Anyway. So that was the goal I set previously. It took me 10 years to convince them that. 10 years to finally reach that.
Yeah, wow. So now, that Mr. Australia that you won in 1973, was what organization was that? Was that IFBB?
No, there wasn't an organization.
Okay.
And it was just a gentleman's agreement that they would, that was shared, the national was shared amongst the states every year with a handshake and an agreement.
Okay.
But there was no OPA, there was no NABA, there was no IFBB.
Yeah. Okay. So then in 1974, then you went over and competed in the Mr. Universe, right? And the IFBB Mr. Universe.
Correct, because Frank Burwash, who was gym owner in Melbourne,
mm-hmm.
and very keen on being involved in the international scene, and I suggested to him that he should join me, or that Australia should be amalgamated with the IFBB.
Mm-hmm.
He went through those processes, sort of naively, I think, in retrospect. And so he wanted to attend the universe. That was in, where was that? Verona, wasn't it?
Yeah, Verona, Italy, yeah.
Verona. Fortunately for me, he paid for my fare.
Mm-hmm.
Because airfares were extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And it was literally, that was a round the world trip. I mean,
yeah.
Australia, Europe, yeah.
Right.
So, and sponsored me for three universe trips, as it happens.
Yeah. Now, what did you think of that contest? Lou Ferrigno was the winner there, and Ken Waller was second, and Paul Grant was third, and you were right behind them.
I thought it was a good contest. Mm-hmm. So, considering that was my first international.
Right.
Coming through was a realistic position from a base where no one knows who the hell you are.
Yeah.
With respect, Lou Ferrigno didn't blow me away.
Mm-hmm.
He was taller, and that was it.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned. And his dad was pulling the strings.
Oh, really?
Well, he would stand behind the curtains calling out numbered poses.
Oh, really?
And Lou would hit the pose that his dad was calling out.
His dad was standing behind the curtain telling him what pose to hit? Wow,
yeah.
Really? No kidding.
Well, because I think his dad was living through his son.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where the final schism came, when maybe Lou realized that, you know, he wanted to be the architect of his own successful demise.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of Ken Waller?
Well, no, think of Ken Waller. Well, he was famous. He'd been in magazines.
Yeah.
He was famous, but none of them scared me.
Uh-huh.
None of them scared me. I mean, I had respect for them, but none of them scared me.
Right. Okay.
And Ken always came to me anyway. Ken always came across as a very pleasant person.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I heard he was a pretty nice guy.
Very pleasant. Yeah.
I
mean, there's stories, and I think most of it is made up for the comeback and all those funny things, all those
right.
funny movies. To me, Ken was always very kind, very friendly.
Right.
Absolutely no problems. And very funny, I might say.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
Yeah, very witty.
Uh-huh. So did you get to know those guys at that show? Did you meet them at all?
Well, I don't go to a contest to make friends.
Yeah.
Right, so I always found it difficult. And I certainly didn't want to talk to anyone before the contest.
Mm-hmm.
That's a sign of weakness.
Okay.
That may sound a bit strange. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I don't want to look at anyone.
Uh-huh.
I can't control how they look. I can only control how I present myself, and that's where my focus was.
Right.
And I couldn't think you can't control anything. You can't even control the music.
Yeah.
It's almost, so I never got into conversations.
Okay.
And I might have said a few things like goodbye, nice to meet you, but I never really. No, I didn't want to be friends with anyone.
Yeah. Okay.
I wanted to beat them.
So, what were your feelings after that show? Were you really motivated to come back to the universe the following year?
I was very happy. I was very happy with my place in Court Place,
yeah.
First time out, and I thought it was doable.
Okay.
I thought it was very, very doable.
Yeah. When was the first time you ever saw Arnold Schwarzenegger? Because I remember, I think I had an old videotape of Arnold guest posing in Australia. This had to be around 73 or 74 when he was at his peak, and I thought you were at that show.
I first met Arnold in Bruges in Belgium
okay.
in 72.
Okay.
He'd just done a tour of South Africa,
mm-hmm.
and the stage, I believe this is the story, the stage had collapsed and he damaged his knee.
Yeah, I remember that.
So the Belgian boss rang Wag Bennett and said, we may need a stand-in for this Mr. Belgian show. Do you have anybody? And so I didn't have a phone, so Wag sent me a telegram. Can you make it to Bruges this weekend?
Hmm.
This was Thursday evening.
Okay.
And I said, yeah, okay. And I didn't even ask how much he was going to pay me or anything. And I was training, but I hadn't trained for this exhibition. So I got to the airport, met. No, I hadn't, because Wag was already there. So I got to the airport, got my convention, landed in Bruges, plane was late. And I met Arnold about 11 o'clock at night. I was starving, he was starving. We went and had food in Belgium at the time was difficult if you're a bodybuilder, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I met Arnold, he was very charming. And he managed to do the show. I did it as well. They paid me £20,
uh-huh.
which was a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's about a week late.
Yeah.
It was. So that was my first exhibition. And that's when I met Arnold.
Okay. So were you starstruck meeting him? Because he had to be famous too, right, in the magazines at the time?
I know this. I don't want to sound arrogant, but not particularly.
Okay.
I'm not really a fan type person.
Uh-huh.
I have musicians that I like, I have singers that I like,
uh-huh.
but I'm not into titillation. Really, I can't do that.
Right. What did you think of his physique, Roger?
Amazing. It was amazing. Yeah. He was in great shape in 72.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I always.
It was a whole level up.
Yeah. I like
that. When he first came to the UK, Wag Bennett, where he trained, sent him down to Portsmouth to train with my old workout partner.
Mm-hmm.
Because he'd won another universe, but at that stage he still didn't know what the hell he was doing.
Yeah.
So that's how much talent he had. And Gordon Allen, my old training partner, beat the crap out of him, and an extremely strong guy, mm-hmm. and helped get him in shape, and then send him back to WAG.
Oh, really?
So in that 2 or 3 years, he certainly come on and looked in great shape.
Yeah, okay. So going back to 1975 then, after you took fourth place at that universe, you won the the Asian Amateur Championships and the Mr. Australia in 1975, huh?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I felt, although Frank Burrish wanted to include me in the Asian team, I didn't want it to look as if I was getting preferential treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, look, I'll enter the Australia again. Because I don't want people to think that anyone's doing me a favor.
Okay.
That's the reason. And plus, I needed. Without contests, I always found it very difficult to train.
Okay.
Because what's the point?
Yeah.
I didn't train just to impress girls or beat up civilians.
Right.
I wanted to train to compete against bodybuilders.
Right.
That's the only thing that counted. So if there wasn't a contest, I found it difficult to motivate myself to go through into that little room and beat the shit out of myself for a couple of hours. It seemed pointless.
Yeah.
So I needed the Australia, and then I had the Asia, and then I had the universe.
And
they were quite closely packed.
Yeah.
And I was buggered at the end of it.
The universe that year was in South Africa, and that was the one that was part of the movie Pumping Iron, of course, which is now really very famous.
Sure.
Did you know anything about the movie going on at that time when you were in the show?
I knew they were filming it.
Mm-hmm. You probably had no idea that the movie was going to be as big as it was, though, right? I'm sure nobody really had any idea it was going to be that big of an impact on the sport. Mm-hmm.
But it was big comparative to what's gone before, but it's still a cult movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the majority of the people in the world have never heard of Pumping Iron.
Yeah.
Right? It's only people like us who've heard of it.
Right.
And I was aware that, and I was certainly well aware of the camera crew that were following a particular script that they, or someone else had written.
Right. How did you feel the competition was that year? You ended up getting second place that year to Ken Waller. So you beat out Paul Grant and you beat out Mike Katz.
I was happy with that position.
Mm-hmm.
I was fairly happy. Some people I know have said I should have won, but when you're involved, it's really too difficult to say, yeah, I was better than him. I thought it was fairly close, and I was happy.
Yeah.
I was confident that I would beat Mike Katz, and I was very confident of beating the Welshman.
Yeah. Did you feel it was political at all because of the movie, that Waller was going to win?
No, I was really focusing on, and I was young and naive at the time, which changed. No, I was just focusing on the contest. This is my third contest in a very short space of time.
Yeah.
I was feeling very flat. I was very tired. I'd done the Australia. I'd flown to Singapore. Atmospheric training conditions in Singapore are extremely difficult.
Yeah.
you wanted to train with high intensity. From there, we'd gone to the Philippines, which was even worse
right.
as far as training is concerned. I was happy. I was happy with the contest.
So tell me about your training at that time, Roger. You sound like you trained very hard, and I'm friends with Peter McGuff out here in Florida, and I think he wrote something recently about seeing you at a gym out in England, and he said everybody was very impressed with you, with your physique, and how hard you trained, and I heard that, you know, the people in England are very hard trainers.
When I started training properly in the gym,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't just, and it was a bodybuilding gym. Strength was always important to me, and strength in general, I think, I can't speak for American bodybuilders, but for English bodybuilders, strength was immensely important.
Okay.
In the gym I trained at, if you couldn't bench press, and this was a long time ago, if you couldn't bench press 400 pounds, squat 500, and do a standing military press of 300, you weren't there.
Wow.
You weren't there. That was the benchmark.
Yeah.
That was the my training partner was one of the strongest guys I've ever met, and that's clean too.
Hmm.
If I could just tell a story. Yeah. One day we hadn't managed to meet at the same time, so I'd started. He came in to do press behind neck, and he was at the squat rack, and a guy I obviously thought that Gordon was going to do squats. So they started with one. They started with 120, and the guy squatted, and Gordon pressed behind neck. They went up to 220. And the guy squatted, and Gordon pressed behind neck. Gordon shoved on another. Gordon went up to 320, and the guy said, "Thanks very much." And, no, thank you. And he was still pressing. He was still pressing behind neck.
Wow!
And ripped, not single. Right?
Yeah.
And it took me about 2.5 years to finally take Gordon on all the lifts.
Oh, really? Wow.
It took me 2.5 years to squat more than him, to bench more than him, to press more than him.
Yeah, yeah.
It was very, very strong. So that was, strength, yeah, I enjoyed strength, and I think people expected you to be able to demonstrate that strength.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, way back, one of the problems nowadays is that there's no active component to bodybuilding.
Yeah.
It's just a show thing.
Right, posing, yeah.
It's just fluff. It's just all show and no go.
Right.
Whereas 50 years ago, 60 years ago, there used to be a strength component in there.
Yeah.
And in fact, when it was connected to the respective weightlifting organizations, it was usually a middleweight weightlifter who'd already proved that he was more than just show. That would be entering those contests.
Right, right.
And probably in a way, I think it's a shame that we've departed from that.
Mm-hmm.
No, that sounds silly.
Yeah. Right. Well,
and that's why it would never be accepted by the general public, because as far as they're concerned, we're just pumped up little, you know, bodybuilders.
Right, right.
Aren't they?
And people may not.
Where were we?
People today may not realize it because, I mean, the gyms today are so so advanced and everything. But back then, the gyms were very small, and all you had was just you know, barbells and dumbbells, just the basic exercises.
Well, I don't think the gyms today are more advanced. I think the equipment is more expensive.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that the movement's better.
Right, right.
I think we have people using straps. And they strap themselves to a lat bar.
Mm-hmm.
They strap themselves to a dumbbell for a dumbbell row.
Right.
I mean, that's why God gave his fingers. and if you need straps, then you're using too much weight.
Yeah, right.
I just think it's like wearing Lycra and working out. It's a bit effeminate.
Yeah, right.
A little bit effeminate. But that's just me.
Right. All right, going back to your career then, in 1976, you entered the IFBB Mr. Universe, which was in Montreal, Canada, and you won first place in the heavyweight class. How did you feel your condition was in 1976 compared to 1975, and how did you like the contest?
Prior to that contest, I was still in the Australian Air Force at the time.
Okay.
And in 74 and 75, I had to apply for special leave to be able to take my leave, allowed me anyway, to be able to attend. And for those first 2 years, 74, 75, I had no problem. In 76, suddenly they had a problem with me. And they wouldn't give me the leave. And I suggested that if I'd played rugby or played cricket for Australia, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Anyway, my CO called me a bullshit artist. That was his phrase. I think you're a bullshit artist. Okay. So I had to be bad. I had to go. I went on holiday. I went absent without leave.
Oh, really? Okay.
I went away for a week. And if I'd have been in the Marines, I wouldn't have dared do that.
Yeah.
They would have kicked this living crap out of me. Anyway, I went away for a week. I came back. And they said, that's really bad. You're restricted to base for a weekend. And I thought, well, no, this is not what I want to hear. And I said, I'd like to go home and get my toothbrush. They said, okay. So I went home and I went away for another week. And this time, when I drove back, they said, okay. We're going to lock you up for, I think, 3 weeks.
Wow.
So they locked me up for 3 weeks. It was nothing. Again, if I'd have been in the Marines, I would never have done this because it's a different game.
Yeah.
So they locked me up for 3 weeks. I couldn't train for 3 weeks. That was horrible. But it wasn't. It really wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
I'd done worse. They let me out, and then they finally discharged me. Now, my lead-up period, this had all eaten into my preparation period. But they finally gave me a discharge, and obviously I was very motivated because I was motivated on two fronts. One, I thought it was my time, fourth, second, and now the number one.
Right.
And my other motivation was that the bloke who called me a wanker or a bullshit artist, I wanted to prove that I certainly wasn't.
Right.
Okay. I may be many things, but I'm not one of them.
Right.
So my preparation wasn't as good as I wanted it to be. And if I was truthful, I probably felt I might have been in better shape in 75.
Right.
But I won it.
Yeah. And then you beat Albert Beckles' cousin, right? Darcy Beckles? Was that the show?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was in good shape.
Yeah, he was. He had a good physique.
Yeah, he was very good.
So how did you feel then coming home, Mr. Universe winner, and now you could be a professional bodybuilder?
Well, when I got home, no one believed me. They said, no one in Australia believed me. Not that it particularly bothered me.
Yeah.
But they just didn't believe that an Australian could win a universe, because
right.
No one ever has.
Right, really? Okay.
No one ever had. And then I had other remarks saying, yeah, but there were no Americans in the heavyweight.
Oh, okay.
And I said, well, that's not my fault.
Right, right.
Montreal is not that far to travel.
Right.
So maybe they chose not to. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Because Mensa and the other guys were around then. But they chose to skip Montreal. Anyway, I won it.
Yeah. So then, going into 77, you decided to go into the Mr. Olympia then, right?
Yep.
Now, did Arnold call you? Because he was promoting the show then. Did he call you and ask you to compete in the show?
I thought Arnold was entered. No, hang on.
He was promoting it, yes.
Yeah, you're right, 77. Yes, I did have an invitation.
Okay.
So the rules were then, if you'd won an IFBB universe, you were automatically...
Okay, that's right. Qualified. Yeah.
If you entered and came in the top 10, then the next year, your travel arrangements would be paid for.
Okay.
That was the criteria.
And that was the first year that Frank Zane won. How did you feel about that show? How did you feel about how Zane looked and Robbie and those guys?
The guys looked fantastic. I really screwed up my preparation, mm-hmm. and that was the last time that I listened to anybody's advice. I'd actually listened to someone this time. That was a mistake, and I never repeated that mistake.
What did they tell you to do that screwed you up?
They said you need to be lean and cut and everything else, and I was focusing on that rather than. The other criteria was to be full, balanced, symmetrical, separated, etc., etc.
Right.
Well, I went too far that way.
Yeah, like I said, I went to all three of those shows that were in Columbus in the late 70s, 77, 78, and 79. And I remember you, Roger, because I remember that every year that you competed, every year that I saw, you were significantly improved every year from 77 to 78 to 79. So you were one of the guys that always stood out to me, even though I was just a teenager at the time watching it. I always remember seeing how you improved significantly every year.
Thanks very much. America, for foreigners, America is always a difficult place to compete.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not American, I'm saying this with respect, if you're not American, they don't applaud.
Oh, yeah.
It's nothing, silence.
Right.
If they don't know you, if they're not aware, then they don't applaud either.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult environment to compete in.
Yeah.
Not that the fans aren't friendly or anything. It's just a difficult, for a foreigner, it's very difficult.
Did you ever travel to the United States just to train for a while? Or did you just always stay in Australia? I said, did you ever, during that time when you were competing back then?
Just repeat, that's a bad line.
Did you ever travel to the United States to train? Or did you just always stay in Australia?
No, I just wanted to stay in Australia.
Okay.
I had the opportunity, but I knew what the Gold's Gym culture was.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really want to be part of it.
What do you mean by that? You just didn't like the California?
No, I thought, how do I put this? A lot of the guys weren't working.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of them were hustling.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it legal, some of it not legal.
Yeah. Okay.
Some of it moral, some of it immoral. I don't care.
Right.
Didn't want to be part of that.
Right. Okay. Going into that 78 Olympia then, what were your thoughts on that show?
I was definitely better than 77. I was better than 77.
Yeah.
No, so it was a learning curve.
Yeah.
It's a big jump from the universe to Olympia.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That was only one jump. There were a few professional bodybuilding contests.
Right.
And the ones that were held in America.
Right.
And they weren't going to spend money flying me in when they could have locals for $200 or $300 airfares instead of the $1,500 airfare. So I was never going to get invitations to those.
Right. After those, when you competed in those Mr. Olympias each year, were you really motivated to go back and improve more after seeing those guys?
Yeah, the more I trained, the more I saw what was going on backstage, the more I was convinced that this wasn't anything that I couldn't transcend.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't anything I couldn't beat.
Right, okay. And then you really improved in 79. You went up to third place, right, in the over 200-pound class at the Olympia.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
What were your thoughts on that show? Anybody stand out there?
I think Torino. Dennis Torino beat me.
Yeah, and Mike Mentzer.
I thought they were lucky.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
I thought they were lucky because I thought I was better.
Okay.
But that's just true.
Yeah. So then in 1980, it was going back to Australia for the first time ever. Did that really motivate you, knowing that it was going to be in Australia?
You're going to get me into trouble here. Yeah, go on. Sorry.
That's all right. So it was coming to Australia in 1980. When you heard that, did that really motivate you to train hard for that Olympia that year?
I didn't train any harder for the Sydney Olympia than I did any other.
Okay.
Because I knew that was going to be harder for me than for the visitors.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the promoter and the president of the IFBB.
Paul Rudd.
And myself fell out a long, long time ago.
Oh, really? Yeah. That was Paul Graham, right? The promoter of the show?
Correct.
Yeah. When did you guys have a falling out?
I think early 79.
Oh, or the year before. Okay.
Early 79, maybe 78, we fell out.
Okay. Did you feel that was going to hurt your placing at the show?
Definitely.
Yeah.
But 80 wasn't as bad. 80 was a show, it wasn't a contest.
Uh-huh.
If you understand the difference.
Right, right. So did you know Arnold was going in it before the show?
Yes.
You did? How long before the show did you know?
A number of weeks.
Oh, really? Okay. Because a lot of the competitors were surprised that he was there and they didn't know. But you knew, being from Australia, you knew?
I'd heard in the grapevine, and it made sense that he would, mm-hmm. in light of the fact that Paul Graham was the promoter.
Okay. Because him and Arnold were friends?
More than friends.
Okay. did you feel that it had something to do with that movie, The Comeback? That's what I heard. I heard that... you know, they gave Paul the contest so he could do a movie that was going to be similar to Pumping Iron.
Have you read the article that was in Iron Brothers, Once Upon a Time in Australia?
I don't think so, no. Who wrote that?
It's anonymous.
Okay.
But you'd have to read that, and that would lay out the full details of what happened in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why, if I could go back to one of the points, why on earth would Ben Weider give the Olympia to a convicted criminal from Australia?
Right.
Why would he give him his baby?
Right, right.
That's a question that begs. It was only the second time, the first time it was held in Germany, it was the first time out of America.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time, Paul Graham, who is a convicted of criminality in California, as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Why would Joe Weider, Ben Weider, present Arnold with a Paul with this gift?
Right.
Now, and my other point is, who in their right mind could possibly believe that Arnold woke up one morning in sunny California and decided 8 weeks out, after 5 years in retirement,
mm-hmm.
that he was going to compete in an Olympia that at that scale he'd never competed in before.
Right.
This wasn't three people, two people.
Right.
A couple of people. This was 30-odd people, compulsory poses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
He'd never gone through anything.
Right, right.
Why would he put his reputation on the line 8 weeks out. Doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it does make sense if you believe that obviously Paul Graham knew that he would have the Olympia a year out. So I believe that as Paul was awarded the Olympia, it was ipso facto that Arnold was going to be awarded, not win, would be awarded the number one position.
Right.
It was a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute no-brainer. So, I mean, the next year was just as interesting.
Yeah, I was at that
where a guy with one leg won the contest.
Right.
I mean, it turned into vaudeville.
Yeah.
It was vaudeville. It was a joke. He insulted us. And then Arnold, apart from that, insulted us all by saying, I've done, in his accent, I won't even try to pull it off, I've done in 8 weeks what these guys have been doing, been training for 52 friggin' weeks.
Right.
Right? So, apart from that, he insulted us.
Yeah, yeah.
And my other point is I doubt very much whether Paul Graham actually paid him the prize money. Because there were some dynamics going on behind the scenes, and if you read that article, you'll see what. And I'm not going to tell you what they are now, because I could be sued.
Okay.
But when you read it, you'll see the facts. Lots of people know those facts and choose to ignore them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one guy on Facebook said, look, it's been a long time, 98 is a long time ago, let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Let it go.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that the other night. I'm thinking, well, if I saw a guy with a watch, he was wearing his watch, and it was so precious and expensive that they only made one a year, that it was almost beyond money, and he was wearing it, and I knew he had stolen it, should I say, oh, nice watch? Or should I say, why are you wearing a stolen watch?
Mm-hmm.
Or what should I say?
Right.
What would you do? What would you say?
So why are you wearing a stolen watch?
So Arnold is wearing a stolen watch.
Mm-hmm.
Stolen.
Right, right.
He committed fraud with the help of all his friends.
Yeah.
And that is not sour grapes.
Right.
And that is not to say that I deserve any higher placing. I'm just saying the most difficult part of that show, apart from fiddling Arnold's position, was what do they do with the Cordy Ballet? What do they do? How do they place the also-rans?
Mm-hmm.
And that was their biggest problem.
Right.
What do we do? Should we put Dane in there? What do we do? Oh, I guess. Let's pull a hat. Let's pull a rabbit out of a hat.
Right, okay. Right.
And what happened the second year was just disgraceful.
Yeah.
So is there any need?
In 1980, when you guys were all getting ready to go out and you're pumping up and you looked at Arnold, what did you think? What did you think of his physique?
Not ready.
Not ready?
Not ready.
Not big enough or not cut enough or both?
Just not ready, not in contest shape.
Yeah.
I'd seen Arnold.
Right, you saw him at his best.
The first time I saw Arnold was in 72, and I thought, wow.
Yeah.
And that, I don't say that very often. Well, I didn't say that very often. I thought, wow. But I didn't say that then. And he was human then.
Yeah.
Up to 74. 75 was a bit dodgy, but up to 74, he wasn't human.
Wow.
He was beyond the pack.
Wow, yeah.
He looked better than his pictures.
Yeah.
When you saw him in the flesh, he looked way better than his pictures.
Wow. That's amazing.
75. He was clever. But again, he managed to manipulate two people. Lou, who is, and Serge Newbray.
Mm-hmm.
Who, interestingly enough, actually won the world presidency that year. But the guy who was counting the votes managed to save Ben's backside.
What did he win? What did Serge win?
Well, every year at the World Championships, the position of president, world president, was up for grabs.
Okay.
Up to 75. Serge was president of Europe and president of France, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So he carried most of Europe. He carried the West Indies. And he carried a lot of the African countries. Frank Burrows was there when they voted. Certainly they won the vote. He actually won it.
Mm-hmm.
At the ballot. Who was counting the votes? Oscar Stoight.
Mm-hmm.
So Oscar Stoight recounted them. And Ben won. Shortly after that, Ben was announced as president for life. They weren't going to have any more of this nonsense.
Right, right.
They didn't need to pretend that they were the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Right.
Forget about the Democratic bit. Let's just be president for life, okay? So that's what he became. And, of course, Serge then got purged.
Right.
He was purged because they accused him of making blue movies.
Right.
Which was kind of cute.
Was that in 1975 that they did that?
That was in 75.
Yeah, okay.
Well, they kept him in limbo for a couple of days, stewing. And then finally said, oh, okay, you can enter the Olympia. Otherwise, it's just going to be Arnold and his little mate.
Yeah.
He could make up the numbers. He did make up the numbers. But those 2 or 3 days have probably mentally disintegrated him.
Yeah.
And that was enough.
So why did they get him out? Just because he would have won that vote?
He did win.
He did win,
And Ben didn't want his baby, his IFBB, to get taken over by anybody else.
Right.
It was only meant to look like a democracy. It wasn't really supposed to be one in the way that it operated.
Right.
And it certainly isn't now, is it?
No.
No. Probably degraded even more.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Burrows was there at the time and became completely despondent in regard to what he saw. Because he believed that he'd actually joined an international organization that was fair dinkum, that was fair and square.
Right.
And very soon afterwards, he left in disgust and wanted no more to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, sad. Maybe a little nervous, but sad.
That's when Paul Graham took over then, after that.
Well, Paul sort of stole the presidency. Most of the bodybuilders in Australia voted him out of the National Federation. He rang Ben and cried on his shoulder and said, Ben, they've taken the IFBB off of me.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben patted him on the shoulder, reassured him it's okay, form another organization that's the only one that the IFBB will recognize, and they can all get stuffed. And that's what he did.
Okay.
And we still have the same criminal in charge in Australia today, which is why we now have at least 4 different organisations, because nobody really wants anything to do with Paul Graham.
Okay.
And I don't want to come across as a whinging, whining person. It's a shame.
Yeah. Let me take you back to 1980, because I heard when... at the prejudging, I heard you and Arnold were sort of standing next to each other, trading elbows with each other during the mandatories.
I didn't take that as being aggressive.
Yeah.
I didn't take offense. It was just part of the, I'm in my light, and I'm not moving.
Yeah.
You've been on stage, you know what it's like. You find the light.
Right.
You stay in the light. You don't walk away from that light.
Right.
And you don't give ground to someone else and what's standing in your light.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's all that happened.
Okay.
It wasn't about to break out into violence.
Yeah.
Which would have been good for the show, but it was never going to be a violent thing. Just I wasn't giving way. Arnold wasn't giving way. Right. I didn't take offense. Okay.
Were you backstage when him and Mensur almost got into it?
I was right there.
Yeah. What happened there?
The meeting was going on quite smoothly. Everyone was deciding whether there was going to be two classes or one.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone decided that, yeah, why not one? Arnold wanted two classes because he already figured that he'd gone through the WWF playbook and decided that this is how he wanted to compete against a shorter guy at the fight. Because he was already going to be the tall guy, right?
Right.
He already decided. And out of the blue and out of context, he made some snidey and childish remark about Mike Mensur's guts.
Mm-hmm.
Mike took offense. Unfortunately, and this is the saddest part, unfortunately, he was stopped. Because I had ringside seats, and I thought, wow, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
I'm going to see, you know, that movie, The Clash of the Titans?
Yeah,
I thought,
yeah.
Wow, it's going to be great. I'm going to sit back, and I'm going to watch this bit. It's nothing like watching a good fight, right?
Right.
Enjoyed the fight. Stand in the corner of a bar, and just drink away quietly, and watch the living crap out of each other. Right. That's my thing, right? But unfortunately, it was stopped.
Yeah. Was Mensur ready to hit him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I reckon he would have taken him out, too.
Yeah. And Bill Pearl stopped him, right?
I think it was Ben.
Oh, Ben, yeah.
I think Ben stepped in.
Okay.
It was very, very funny. I was roaring with laughter. I thought the funniest things I ever say. Because you know, bodybuilding contest, everyone's in great shape.
Right.
Lots of testosterone.
Right.
But it's all pent up, and you can't actually, well, you'd like to sometimes, sure. I mean, you'd like to smack someone,
right.
But it's really aggressive.
Right.
But that's it. It's like sleeping with a woman without actually going there, right?
Right.
It's very frustrating because there is no physical thing to it apart from the posing, which is done properly.
Right.
Can be harder than people think.
Right.
It's actual head-on physical aggression.
Right.
That's why I thought this is great. Maybe that's just me.
What was the prejudging like? How was Arnold acting on stage? I heard like Bill Pearl said he was like the most aggressive competitor he ever saw.
He was doing exactly what he wanted. And Oscar State, who was supposed to be controlling the stage, was letting him get away with doing anything he wanted.
Right.
He was warned constantly and warned about being disqualified. But obviously, that was never going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If I'd have done that, I would have been out of my ear.
Right. Who did you feel were the top competitors that year, as far as the condition of the athletes? Who did you feel was the top guys?
I think the top five, no, from two to eight.
Yeah.
That was about, 2 to 8 was fair.
Yeah, okay.
And then you make your own choices as far as the body type you like.
Yeah.
As eight people. So right. I'm not going to speculate on positions, but I'd say that take Arnold out because he wouldn't have made the 8. He wouldn't have made the 7 either. So from 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
Okay. I think Dennis Tenorino was 8.
Yeah.
In there. Roy Callender was, I've seen Roy in better shape.
Mm-hmm.
in the 80s. I think he was a little off. I think he was lucky to get that high.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, from 2 to 8, which should have been, would have been where the proper contest would have begun.
So you wouldn't even have Arnold in the top 8 then? Wow. Roger, what do you say?
I was standing next to him. I was looking right up close. I know what he looks like. And people try to fiddle on Facebook. They play around with photographs.
Right, right.
They use
right.
photographs from the wrong year and say, this is, yeah, I'm here, but it's not, that wasn't 18. They pick and choose. He wasn't in shape. Simple as that.
Yeah. Sorry. I've talked to quite a few people who were at that contest. I talked to Bill Pearl. I talked to Samir Benoud. I talked to Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson. And everybody said Arnold was 5th or lower. And it's funny when you see, like you talked about Facebook, when you see the pictures or you hear the bodybuilding forums and people argue about it, the people that weren't there always say, well, he wasn't at his best, but I could see how he could win because he still looks better than everyone else. But everybody that was there said that he shouldn't have even placed in the top 5.
Well, no. With respect to Arnold, his best year was 74.
Right.
He was fortunate in 75. He should have left it with that.
Yeah.
There was no need. His movie career would have carried on just as well.
Yeah.
What did he do? He made a laughing stock. The film crew that came over from America to film it put the film in the trash can.
Right.
It's never seen the light of day. It's been destroyed.
Right.
But they thought the bodybuilders were just a bunch of wankers and cheats, probably. They thought it was a joke.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, he sullied, he besmirched the reputation of bodybuilding for his own ego.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's what he did.
Yeah.
Stole the watch.
Yeah. So after the show was over, what was the feeling of the crowd and everything after it was announced, you know, that Arnold won and everybody placed where they placed?
Well, Arnold had never been booed before. Now, in that movie, I think the booing, they dubbed out the booing.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was that much booing that you couldn't hear them talking.
Wow, really?
They wouldn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
They just wouldn't stop. And even Arnold, who wasn't expecting that booing, who thought he could pull this WWF thing off.
Yeah.
That making it off the ropes, makes a comeback, and he's won again.
Yeah.
He looked decidedly embarrassed.
Hmm.
The booing wouldn't stop. The crowd didn't like it. And I would say, everybody in the room was booing.
Wow. No kidding. Everybody
in the house was booing.
Wow. No kidding.
Because it doesn't matter what country you're from. We can all smell bullshit.
Right. So the next year, when it went back to Columbus, there was quite a few bodybuilders that boycotted the show. Boyer Coe, Mike Mentzer, Frank Zane, I think Albert Beckles, all of them stayed away from it because they felt like they knew that Franco was going to win. You decided to do the show. Were you aware of that boycott? Were you aware that some of the people were competing?
I had received a phone call from Boyer Coe asking me to boycott the 81. I explained to him that I wasn't in the same position as him in regard to publicity and a footprint in the Parthenon of bodybuilders, and I needed to compete. He was he was well established, and the other guys were too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't. I didn't have many magazine covers. Didn't get many stories. That didn't bother me, but it helps.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't boycott it. I'd never contemplated, even though I'd read somewhere that I had. I never contemplated boycotting it, even though I knew it was coming.
Yeah. So tell us how you felt about that show, because I was at that show and I saw what happened. Like you said, Franco won without any legs at all.
We had one leg.
One leg.
Yeah, one.
Right. So how did you feel that all went?
What could you do?
I mean, were you surprised after 1980 that this happened again? No.
No, not at all.
Were you expecting it to happen?
I picked up the WWF playbook. I turned the page from 31 to 32. The dog-eared page. And I read the script, and I knew exactly what was coming.
Yeah.
I knew, it's like watching a train wreck. You can see it. I knew it was coming.
Yeah.
So, I could tell by the number of call-outs I got.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got two.
Yeah.
And how do you go from two call-outs to being a player from the year before?
Mm-hmm.
Someone had obviously marked my card.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, really.
How did you feel your condition was in 81 compared to 80?
I thought it was quite good.
Yeah. Okay. How about some of the other guys that were standouts at that show, like Tom Platz, Danny Padilla?
I've always liked Danny's physique.
Yeah, me too.
And I've always liked the person. Absolutely awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. With respect to Tom. No. The body just doesn't fit with the legs.
Mm-hmm.
It was about symmetry. He never had it.
Yeah.
Never had it.
Right.
He was probably the beginning of grotesque.
Oh, really?
Of the grotesque era.
Yeah.
He was the forerunner to the grotesque era.
Yeah.
Where symmetry is not counted.
Yeah.
He had great legs. Don't get me wrong, great legs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, overall, great legs. But they didn't fit. Now, if they don't fit, what's the point?
Right.
There is no point.
Who were some of the bodybuilders from that era, Roger, that you really admired? You mentioned Danny Padilla. Who were some of the other guys that you really thought had great physiques of that time?
It's one of them, really. Hmm. They were all world class. They were all world class bodybuilders.
Yeah, yeah.
Bodybuilding is difficult to judge because you sometimes tend, subconsciously perhaps, you sometimes tend to judge the type of physique that you would like or are like or admire the most.
Yeah.
So you tend to obviously go to that. If you're Herculean, you tend to swing to that Herculean look rather than that aesthetic look.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Frank Zane was the master, absolute master of creating illusion.
Yeah.
But if you saw him backstage, you walk past him.
Hmm.
He had, with respect again, right?
Mm-hmm.
He has so many weak spots. You look at it and think, well, that funny little rib box. And then you see something else and think, well, that looks strange as well. That doesn't quite fit. But when he walked on the stage, he was an absolute master, and I think he used the phrase himself, of creating an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, to this day and age, they no longer have to create an illusion.
Right.
They're all as big as a two-door fridge. Right? There's no need to make an illusion.
Right.
Frank used to compete, what, 180, 85?
Yeah.
With, if the truth be known, 18-inch arms.
Mm-hmm.
But how did it look?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember his David pose?
Mm-hmm.
With Andrew David, where he's got, that, I think, a sling over one shoulder. It's the one in Florence, you know, the statue in Florence.
Yeah.
He looked like David.
Yeah, yeah.
absolutely marvellous. Extremely clever. I love the way that he didn't get dragged into competing against other people at their own terms.
Yeah, yeah.
Which a lot of people make the mistake. If you've got strength, it's just like a football team. If you've got strength, you play with your strength. You don't try to compete with the strength of the other team.
Right, right.
And he never did that. He recognized quite early on, I think 78, no, 68.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He recognized quite early on what he could do. And if he did the other, he would be competing, looking the same as them.
Right, right.
Extremely clever guy.
Yeah.
And charming, too.
Okay. 1982, that was your last Olympia, right? That was the last one you competed in?
Yeah.
And that was in London, right? Oscar State was a promoter there?
I don't know.
Yeah. How did you feel that show went? That was the one that Chris Dickerson won, I believe, right?
I knew that was my last hurrah.
Mm-hmm.
I had an injury. And it was making training difficult.
Okay.
But I thought, I'll take the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my last contest.
What kind of injury did you have, Roger?
I had a joint injury.
Oh, okay. How did you feel about that last show? How did you feel that went?
It was interesting. I shared a hotel room with a judge.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, an English judge, and I got stripped off the night before, and he said, you know what? He said, you don't look half as bad as they say you do. And I said, well, that's interesting. I said, because no one's seen me.
Right.
And I made a point that no one in Australia had seen me. I was training at a completely different gym.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like people sneaking in and having a look and then making an unsolicited opinion.
Right, right.
And I was training in isolation. So when I heard that, I thought, okay, that's poor.
Right.
So I knew where it had come from.
Right, right.
But that was my last contest.
Mm-hmm.
If I hadn't have got that injury, which I had got worse over 2 or 3 years,
mm-hmm.
I would have carried on. But as it happens, probably better that I stopped.
Yeah. So when you look at the sport today, how do you feel about it?
At what end? The top end or the entry end?
Yeah, both. Yeah.
I'd have to really sort of denigrate what's gone on now. It's a different era. It's a different time.
Yeah.
You can't judge a man by a time that's not his.
Right, right.
So you can't pluck a piece of history out of context and then judge it by the morals and the mores of a different era.
Yeah.
And so it's changed, it's moved on, but it's stayed the same.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds a bit conflicting, but so there are a new family of fans who want something that in my era we didn't particularly want.
Mm-hmm.
That might be because of now the availability of different chemical potents,
mm-hmm.
that,
mm-hmm.
that people use and die from. It's a different era, different guy.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier about Tom Platz and how he wasn't symmetrical and his legs were so out of proportion. Do you feel that when judging a bodybuilder, that's one of the most important criteria is the symmetry and the shape back there like it was back in the 70s?
Yeah, I think that's lost.
Yeah.
I think now they have an emphasis on they call it conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
I say that word is used out of context completely because conditioning doesn't mean that. Conditioning means if you're an athletic.
Cardiovascular, right. Yeah. I agree, yeah.
So it's wrong. But I understand what they mean. But they are thin skin, but they don't have muscle separation.
Yeah.
And there's a subtle difference there. And often muscle separation can be viewed from a distance and seen as being muscular.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a balance. And they don't have muscle separation, obviously because of the way they train.
Mm-hmm.
These machines that they design now are almost work themselves.
Yeah.
There's no balance. There's no joint strength. There's no coordination.
Yeah.
There's nothing. They don't use anything. You can go through a workout now and not even pick up a weight.
Right.
You just pull a pin and move a pin.
Right.
And stuff is done sat down. And
yeah.
It's producing, and again with the drug protocol, it's producing a completely different shape.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that all these shapes are looking the same.
Yeah.
Rather than the individual, the dealer,
right,
cats, all these different individual.
Right. Right.
There's nothing functional about any of them at all.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, well, I touched on it briefly before. Functionality was always an important thing. It was always an important thing within the gym that I came from.
Right,
It wanted you to, but are you strong?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you pick up and press 300 pounds?
Right, right.
Without the gloves, without the straps, without anything. Can you do that?
Right, right.
And, I don't think these guys can.
Yeah.
And you can tell they've got no traps.
Mm-hmm.
If you continue using the Smith machine, then you won't get traps.
Right.
Because you're sitting down and you're obviously using a 90 degree bent, so you're not using any supported muscles at all.
Right.
They call them core muscles now.
Right, right.
So now they have to go away and train core muscles because they hadn't trained them in a proper workout. They
right.
haven't trained close.
Right.
You get, you're winding me up. but it's a different game. It's a different era.
Yeah.
There are still weird people telling you that you should be drinking 2 gallons of water a day.
Mm-hmm.
Other weird people telling you that you should be eating 15,000 calories a day.
Right.
And some of them do. But they're able to do that because of the other gear that they take.
Yeah. Right.
It would be naive of anyone to think that it was going to stay the same.
Yeah, yeah.
But if it is, whatever direction it's moving in, whether that's considered good or bad or progressive, it's the responsibility of the judges who determine who's going to take the sugar off the table.
Right.
So if this look is being continually rewarded, it is the judge's fault.
Yeah.
Not the bodybuilder.
Right, right.
The bodybuilder's there to win.
Right.
So it's not their fault.
Right.
It's the promoter who may have an ear into the judges saying, Joe's looking good this year, and I am paying him $100,000 in sponsorship fees, and I want it. It would be nice if he did well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening now.
Yeah.
Right? That's what's happening now.
How's your training now, Roger? Are you still training with weights and still staying pretty active?
I was until quite recently.
Okay.
Because until quite recently, I was living in Beijing.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I was living there for about 8 years.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
I had my own English training school.
Hmm, okay.
Believe it or not, I teach people English.
Oh, really? Okay.
You should have a right. It's interesting. But I flew back from Sydney to Beijing year before last, and I ended up with a DVT. Blood clot.
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm. And I just made the hospital in time.
Wow, no kidding.
I reckon like 15 minutes.
Wow, no kidding.
And it was the most painful thing I've ever experienced. It was off the Richter scale.
Wow.
On a scale of 0 to 10, it was a 20.
Hmm.
And I consider myself quite good with pain.
Yeah.
I nearly fell off a twig. So I had a very expensive operation because the first thing the doctor said was, "Do you have any money?" And like America. And I had the operation there, then came back to Sydney and had the other half of the operation that I hadn't paid for.
Yeah.
So I'm still in the process of getting over that.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're okay.
But before that, I was working out 4 or 5 times a week.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
I was living in a high-rise building, and I was walking the stairs an hour, 2 or 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
So getting DVTs probably has nothing to do with what type of sex you're in.
Yeah.
I was just unlucky.
Yeah. And then lucky.
But I'm okay.
Oh, good, good. Okay, Roger. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us for so long about your career and about your thoughts of your competition.
I'm sorry we got the times and the bugs and all that other nonsense.
Oh, no problem at all. It wasn't bad at all. But okay. Like I said, I grew up admiring your physique, and I've seen you compete several times, and I always admired how good you looked, and thought you were right up there with the best of those guys, and so I loved hearing your stories about some of those old contests.
Okay.
All right, Roger. Well, thank you for joining us from Sydney, Australia, and we appreciate you joining us on the Bodybuilding Legend Show.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom.
Thank you. All right, thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Thank you to Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode. And next week, we will have an interview with Mike Francois, one of the top bodybuilders of the 1990s. And Mike was the winner at the 1995 Arnold Classic. So that's going to be a great interview. Join us next week for that interview. Have a great week, guys. Talk to you then. See you later. Bye.